Hey everybody, I just wanted to thank you so much for your participation in the podcast survey. We had almost 700 responses and they were all really thoughtful and helpful. And I'm just so grateful for your participation and offering your insight and feedback. It's really going to help us make the show even better. And I wanted to announce the winner of the 3-year membership to Thrive Market. Her name is Melissa Skadden. I'm so sorry. I'm probably mispronouncing that. Of course, the winner had to have a last name that I couldn't pronounce confidently. But it's Skadan. And Melissa will be reaching out to you directly to give you information on how you can claim your prize. And we'll be starting to incorporate some of the changes. Really excited about doing that. You probably already noticed some small changes we've been making. And I just love podcasting. I've been doing it for over a decade now, and I can't wait to make the show even better for all of you. So thanks again, everybody. I wanted to tell you about a free online class I'm offering on treating autoimmune disease naturally with functional medicine. It's taking place on Thursday, July 29th at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, and I'll be covering topics like the underlying causes of autoimmunity and how to address them, why most conventional treatments for autoimmune disease fail and can put your health at risk, the most common myths and misconceptions about autoimmunity, and how to use functional medicine to balance your immune system and take charge of your health. I'll also be providing 2 great free resources to everyone who attends, a handout on getting started with the Autoimmune Protocol Diet, or AIP, and a guide to using my 3 top supplements for immune balancing. My goal in this class is to give you a deeper understanding of what autoimmune disease is, what causes it, and how to address those causes using as natural an approach as possible so you can avoid unnecessary drugs and even surgery. I want to empower you with the strategies and tools you need to take control of your health and recover your vitality with the same approaches I've successfully used in my clinic with hundreds of patients over the past 10 years. The class will run for about an hour, and it will be packed with evidence-based practical information that you can put to use right away. Go to cresser.co/autoimmuneclass, that's cresser.co/autoimmuneclass, all one word, to learn more and register. Hey everybody, Chris Cresser here. Welcome to another episode of Revolution Health Radio. This week I'm really excited to welcome Dr. Kenan Sheldon as my guest. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Missouri and one of the top experts in the world on happiness and well-being, motivation, and goals. We're going to be discussing happiness and well-being in this episode, and this is a topic that I am fascinated by. So much of what we do in our lives is in the name of achieving happiness and well-being, but how often do we really investigate what happiness is, what we mean by happiness and well-being, and even more important, how we can achieve more of them, especially from an evidence-based perspective. A lot of the popular ideas about happiness and well-being that are floating around in the culture don't hold up to scientific inquiry, which we'll talk a little bit about in the show. And I think it's important for all of us to know this. In our Adapt Health Coach training program, we talk a lot about how to help others achieve more happiness and well-being. That's one of the main desirable outcomes of health coaching. And so I'm always interested in gaining more insight into this process. And finally, I've been really intrigued by the relationship between health and happiness for many, many years, starting with my own personal experience living with complex chronic illness over a long period of time. And I talk about this with Ken in the episode, but what I found was that there's actually a bi-directional relationship between health and happiness. We tend to think of it this way, that if we're sick or we're in chronic pain or we have a lot of stress going on in our life, that will decrease our happiness, and the key to gaining more happiness is to eliminate or at least reduce our symptoms or our pain or get rid of the disease that we're suffering from. And there's certainly some truth to that. But what I learned in my own experience with chronic illness and also in treating hundreds of patients with chronic illness and training hundreds of doctors who work with patients with chronic illness and hundreds of health coaches now, is that cultivating activities that lead to more happiness actually also improves our health. And that direction is less known and less typically explored by people who are dealing with chronic illness and pain and stress. And it's a direction that I'm really interested in, and something that I've already been talking more about, as you probably notice, and will be talking more about in the future, because I think it's a powerful antidote to dealing with chronic illness and pain and stress. So in this interview with Ken, we're going to talk more about what exactly happiness and well-being are. How do we define these terms? How do we know them? And we're going to answer the question of whether it's actually even possible to work toward more happiness and well-being, or are they predominantly genetically determined? We'll explore why striving for happiness for its own sake doesn't work and may even make you more unhappy. We'll talk about what Aristotle and the Greeks meant by the term eudaimonia and why eudaimonia is so important to happiness and well-being. We'll explore the two things that we should strive for that will bring us more happiness. And then, as I mentioned, we will discuss the relationship between health and happiness and whether health makes us happy, being happy makes us healthy, or both. I think the information in this episode should be taught in school to our children and be part of our basic human education later in life. I mean, after all, who doesn't want more happiness and well-being? So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Ken Sheldon as much as I did, and that you're able to put this into practice in your own life. All right, now that we have that out of the way, let's dive into my interview with Ken Sheldon on happiness and well-being. Ken Sheldon, thank you so much for being here. I've really been looking forward to this.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it as well.
So I want to start with defining some terms, because we use these words like happiness and well-being, and they get used in a lot of different ways by a lot of different people. And I think there's some confusion out there about what happiness really is. Is it just like the subjective feeling of joy? Is it something that's more persistent? How is it different than well-being? How does the concept of eudaimonia come into this? So can we start by just defining some terms that we're going to be using throughout the show?
Sure. Yeah, I have some definite opinions on those questions. It's not just me. I'm in one particular school of thought on these confusions. So the research that I do, I need a criterion variable to try to predict, like if you pursue a certain set of goals and do they help you in your pursuit of happiness, the Thomas Jefferson sense. So I'd need just kind of a simple, straightforward criterion. So people in my school say that happiness is just feeling a lot of positive moods and emotions, not so many negative moods and emotions, and being generally satisfied with your life. And that's called subjective well-being. And we try to keep conceptual ideas out of that measure because we want it to be sort of objective, even though it's subjective. It doesn't, you don't just get it because it's got the thing in it that you're saying predicts happiness. So we want happiness to be just kind of a good feeling, but that doesn't mean we think that that's the most important thing. It's just a convenient side effect of when we manage to behave in eudaimonic ways. And so eudaimonia is a tricky term, goes back to Aristotle. People debate it in lots of different ways, but to me, it just means trying to grow and connect to be a good person. And so that's a very broad description that can apply to a lot of different things that we might do. And how do we tell if things are eudaimonic or not? Well, we've come to the strategy of it's eudaimonic if it makes you happier, if it increases your subjective well-being. And the reason we say that is that almost every eudaimonic type activity that we measure, when people do it, it increases their subjective well-being. But again, we don't think that's the main thing. It's just a side effect. But it's also a very important side effect because if you start doing something eudaimonic, like you're going to express gratitude or you're going to try to be a kinder person, it's awesome if that behavior can be reinforced by good feelings. And so that's what we think of it as kind of a coupled system where we evolved to be good. Dacher Keltner's great book, Born to Be Good. And we also evolved to get good feelings when we are good, when we are eudaimonic. And so that lets us sort of tell what are the best ways to be.
So I was going to ask you about that because on this show we talk a lot about the evolutionary influences on behavior, you know, for everything from diet, why we eat what we eat, to why we're maybe predisposed to being lazy, to conserve energy. And so it sounds like you're saying that the happiness as a sort of side effect of pursuing eudaimonic well-being may be an evolutionary influence or a reward, essentially, that was put there to help us to pursue eudaimonic well-being. Is that right?
That's what I'm saying. And one specific place to see it is in cooperation. From a game theory perspective, we do better as individuals and societies when we cooperate with each other. That's kind of eudaimonic. Well, wouldn't it be great if it felt good to cooperate? And so we think that's part of why the tendency to cooperate evolved, although there's always threats to it and there's defectors and we have to be able to tell who they are and it gets complicated. But yeah, that is the way we think about it.
So let's dive a little more deeply into eudaimonic well-being, which, as you just distinguish, it's distinct from subjective well-being, which is kind of the subjective feeling of happiness. What are some of the key differences between the eudaimonic sense of well-being and the subjective well-being? You've said, I think, before, it's not just a question of feeling good, which is subjective, but doing well, which is the more eudaimonic definition.
Yeah, so we think about eudaimonia as involving action. You're pursuing a goal, you've got a strategy, you're going to be grateful, you're going to be kind. So it's intentional activity that can vary in its quality. And how do we know if we're really pursuing high quality activities and goals? Again, it's because they bring the feeling as an outcome of the activity. So I'm a goal researcher, so I want to say we're going around in the world and we're making decisions about what to do, and that launches us into activity, and then we get feelings as a result that may or may not reinforce that activity.
So where does hedonism play into this? So let's say, would hedonism be like an explicit pursuit of just subjective well-being, just looking for experiences that make you feel subjectively good, but aren't necessarily inherently contributing to anything else? Like there's no working towards a goal, there's no pursuing mastery, there's no contributing to society or some other purpose larger than yourself. It's just purely seeking pleasurable, enjoyable experiences.
Yeah, well, we have to distinguish between hedonism as feeling good and hedonism as a goal or activity where you're trying to feel good. So hedonism is actually pretty strongly related to subjective well-being, which I said is happiness. And so some people don't like that idea because they say, well, is that all it is just feeling good? What if you're just a hedonist? You know, and all you're just trying to, you know, take drugs and, you know, party. And the way we would look at that is a hedonic activity or say materialistic goals and values don't work very well for bringing us happiness. So a hedonistic lifestyle might not work. In fact, the data suggests it tends to backfire. You're shallow, you're not, you know, really trying to expand yourself. You're just trying for pleasure. And so you're probably not even getting it. Whereas if you were doing more eudaimonic type things, you could get it. But the irony is that if you're trying to get it directly, it doesn't work. So we did a study where we randomly assigned people hedonic goals of make myself happier this semester, or eudaimonic goals of improve my values and my ethics. And what we found is that the happiness goals didn't predict actual changes in happiness at all. It just doesn't work. You can't go for it directly. You have to do the good stuff that brings it as a side effect. So I would agree that hedonism as a value system is not great, but I would disagree that subjective well-being is a poor criterion variable just because somebody can mistakenly try too hard to get it.
Right. Okay. So subjective well-being is a sort of natural consequence or outcome of pursuing eudaimonic well-being, of doing good things, I think you said, for good reasons.
Yeah.
So this leads to the next natural question. I mean, this is perhaps a leading question based on what we've already talked about, which is, can happiness be pursued? I think there's an idea out there that people are either kind of naturally happy or by default or naturally tend towards you know, being unhappy, in the same way that someone is, the idea that someone's naturally an optimist or naturally a pessimist. So, you know, how much truth is there to that? I know there's some genetic predisposition that plays a role, but what would you say are the varying factors or influences that contribute to eudaimonic well-being and subjective well-being?
Well, this is a different line of research that I've done. A lot of it with Sonia Lyubomirsky, where we ask the question, can happiness be increased and then the increase maintained, or do we always fall back to where we started? And so this is the idea of a genetic set point. And there's some truth to that, that people vary in their dispositions. Some people are more bubbly, some people are more gloomy. And that's always going to be true for us. We each have our own genetic dispositions. But what Sonia and I have tried to show is that it's not a set point that we have, it's a set range. And so we're able to stay in the top part of our set range with the right kinds of activities. So somebody who's naturally kind of gloomy, if they're living in a good way, a eudaimonic way, they can become sort of content. You know, they're never going to be ecstatic, but they can be pretty content. Whereas somebody who's kind of bubbly already can really have a sort of ecstatic life if they manage to live well.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. That's a very similar concept in the neurobiology of weight regulation. There's the body fat set point. And what happens, the theory goes, when people gain weight is it's a little bit different, because in that case, the set point increases. And then when they engage in certain behaviors to try to lose weight, the body will compensate by in ways that try to go back to the set point. And likewise, if they are trying to gain weight, that can also be difficult because the body wants to maintain that set point. Can the set point itself be changed, or is it just there's a range and you kind of operate within that range based on your behavior?
Yeah. Well, again, I think it's more of a range where there's a most likely, there's the center of the range. So you're likely to head back to that set point. But can the set point be changed? We don't really know. There's different schools of thought on that. I have a sort of genetic perspective, but I'm not a geneticist, so there may be things I don't understand about this. It's not unlikely or implausible that your set point could go up, and now you're used to this new, like you start living better, and now you become used to that higher level of well-being, and that becomes your set point in some fashion. But I don't think it would be a genetic set point. It would be more just staying in the top part of your range because your life is constructed in a way that keeps you there.
This is a question. I don't know if you have any professional interest or experience in this area, but is there any data that you're aware of on how perhaps psychedelics, for example, might influence the set point in either a transitory or semi-permanent or permanent way? I know there's some very interesting work being done right now on MDMA assisted psychotherapy for PTSD that shows that it may be able to cause lasting changes due to neuroplasticity, that psilocybin has some interesting neuroplastic effects. And I'm just wondering if you thought much about this, you know, whether psychedelics could actually play some role in changing the happiness set point.
Sonia has been doing very interesting research on that, and she sees MDMA as a potentially strong route to boosted happiness, but there's not much research on that. There is more research, like you said, on using those kinds of psychedelics to deal with PTSD. The way I would look at that from my point of view that I've been talking about is that when you have PTSD, something terrible has happened to you that you couldn't internalize, and it has lodged you below your set point. So you're stuck in this place that's, you know, you're not the relatively happy person you were before you went to the war, you know, or fought the fires. And so I think the psychedelics may be able to sort of dissolve in a very intense way, or just kind of sweep aside some of that entrenched mental pain that is keeping the person below where they would be if they didn't have that that baggage.
So it's not so much a question of changing the set point. It's perhaps removing obstacles to them living in the higher end of their natural set range.
Yeah.
From your perspective.
So if they could deal with the PTSD, then maybe they'd be back to the kind of average for them. And then maybe they could start to live a new way of living that really causes them to thrive and then even gets them up into the high part of their range.
Right. So since it does seem that the answer to the question, can happiness be pursued, is yes, to some extent within the range of your happiness set point, what are the factors that have the biggest influence on creating both eudaimonic well-being and subjective well-being?
Well, one way to talk about this is in terms of positive psychology intervention research, where you give people some new life practice to try out, and then you see how that affects their subjective well-being or other outcomes, health outcomes, maybe. And there's a lot of them that can work pretty well, especially if they sort of fit with your personality dispositions, if they complement what your strengths are, perhaps, or your interests. You know, so some of the good ones are thinking about your best possible self, like imagining a future in which everything has turned out well, and that you can start to see how you might get from here to there, and it both bolsters you and maybe inspires you and gives you confidence. Random acts of kindness is another one that works pretty well, that we evolve to want to connect with others. And so being kind to others reinforces us and makes us feel good. So there's a lot of different things that people can try. I focus on goals. And the most important thing from my point of view is pursuing life goals that correctly represent your growth potentials. And we call these self-concordant goals. And we see that as a route to getting up to the high part of your set range and perhaps staying there.
I love that. I'm a big believer in that myself. And I think this, you know, ties into what you said before, you know, doing good things for good reasons. So can you talk a little bit more about the impact of goals and whether what we know about the quality of those goals, like you said, that they're concordant, you know, with your vision and your growth potential, but is there a sort of hierarchy of goals? For example, like if I set a goal that involves service to the world or other people, is that going to have a different effect on my eudaimonic well-being than setting a goal to become a better skier myself? You know, what do we know about that?
Yeah, I can talk about that, but I would first say that you don't set these goals to improve your eudaimonic well-being. Pursuing the goals is your eudaimonic well-being.
Right. Good distinction. Yeah.
So, in our goal research, we make a distinction between the what and the why of the goal. So what are you pursuing and why are you pursuing it? And we find that both of those characteristics have eudaimonic aspects and can affect our well-being. So the why of goals is, you know, why am I doing it? Because I really want to, it's interesting, it's valuable, or I feel like I have to, or I feel guilty or bad about myself if I didn't. Mm-hmm. So good reasons or not so good reasons. And so the self-concordance measure is you subtract the bad reasons from the good reasons, and you end up with, to what extent are these goals pursued with, you know, real high quality reasons and not low quality reasons. And that makes a difference for all kinds of things. If you've managed to choose self-concordant goals, you try harder, you succeed better. And when you succeed, your success makes you even happier. Right? So it feels good to succeed, but it feels even better to succeed if they were these self-concordant, these sort of deeply expressive goals. So that's the why. And one piece of advice is, if you're about to start some new goals or some new life course or program, ask yourself why. And if the reason isn't because I can hardly not do it, it's fascinating, I really think this is cool and important. If that's not the reason, watch out. You know, if it's because, oh man, I got to make some more money, you know, or I got to get my parents off my back and do something they tell me to. Right. Those aren't the right reasons. So then the what of goals is the content, like what is the goal actually pointing to? And we make a distinction between intrinsic, which we can think of as eudaimonic contents, and extrinsic, which we can think of as kind of egocentric or even hedonistic goal contents. And that matters too. So the more you your goals orient towards intrinsic values of growth and connection and contribution, and they're not oriented towards money and looking good and status and popularity, the more well-being you get from those goals. So if you were going to advise a friend, what goals should they pursue? You should try to get them to think about these intrinsic values. You can read work by Tim Kasser if you want to find out more about those. They should pursue goals with intrinsic, not extrinsic, goal targets, and they should hopefully pursue them for autonomous instead of controlled reasons. And that comes out of self-determination theory, but we don't have to go into that.
Right. We may. That's really interesting to me too, as well. But I just want to highlight something here because there's a definite parallel in the work that we do in the healthcare field, that I'm sure you're aware of. Motivational interviewing. One of the reasons it's so successful is, if I have a patient that has type 2 diabetes, and I just assume that I know what their motivation is or what their why is, I say, hey, you should lose weight because it's good for you and because it's going to, increase your lifespan, or because you just should, it's usually not very successful. Whereas if, I or somebody else, a health coach, that's a big part of our health coach training, teaching people motivational interviewing, they talk to them, they find out what's most important to them. Maybe they have a grandchild that they want to see grow up and they want to be able to play with them and feel healthy and vital when they do that. If they can really connect to that why, then the outcome is going to be so much more likely to happen in that situation.
Yeah, yeah. Motivational interviewing is really quite consistent with what self-determination theory says about how to motivate others. Basically says, don't try to control them, support their autonomy to make their own choices, to think things through in their own way. And so motivational interviewing it's doing that. It's supporting the autonomy of the client. It's not telling them what to do. And the goal of MI is to have the goal come out of the client's mouth without you having put it there, right?
Right.
And in that case, it's really expressing them and they can really connect their sense of self to it and they're more likely to follow through with it.
Absolutely. And this is like the big aha moment that so many people who come into our coaching program have is, before that, they often think coaching is about telling people what to do. Eat this, sleep more, exercise more, whatever. But we know from so much research that that is just bound to fail. Most people are not going to respond well to that type of intervention. And what you're saying, it's so cool how this all lines up with, eudaimonic research and motivational interviewing is helping people to discover their own motivation for change is a much more powerful approach.
That's right.
So you touched on self-determination theory, and I'd love to just, visit that briefly. What did that challenge initially? I think it was Ryan and Desi that were primarily, introduced that. And what was this sort of prevailing theory about happiness prior to that? What contribution did that self-determination theory make? And how does that line up with what we've been talking about so far?
Well, those are some big questions.
Yeah, I know, and probably controversial and lots of different opinions, but maybe do your best to kind of summarize just from your perspective and you know, your work and where you're sitting.
Well, so DC, his dissertation research back in 1969 was pushing back against behaviorism, pushing back against drive theory. These are all mechanistic explanations of motivation and behavior. And from those perspectives, for example, if somebody gives you money for doing behavior X, you should be positively reinforced and want to do more of that behavior.
Right.
And so DC's research created two situations. One, hey, play with these cool puzzles, see if you like them. Situation two, hey, I'll give you a dollar for every puzzle you solve correctly. And so the participants in these two conditions fool around for a few minutes, and then the researcher leaves and says, hey, I need to make some copies, do whatever you want. And then the researcher watches them while they're during the 5 minutes. That's the free choice period. And the finding was that people didn't want to play with the puzzles anymore if they had been doing them for money. And so what had happened was their intrinsic motivation to do the puzzles had been undermined by the money. And in fact, the way you would say that in behaviorism, it had been punished by the money.
Right.
So if I smile at you and you frown and I stop smiling, then your frown punished me and I'm not smiling anymore.
Right.
He found that money punished the enjoyment of the behavior and made it go away. So this is really important in showing that our experience matters. You can't just reduce things to conditioning or brain processes or molecules or anything else. It's that it matters how it feels to be us in the world. And our intrinsic motivation is hugely important, but it's also fragile. If people start trying to control us and push us around and coerce us, we could say, not doing that.
I just want to, yeah, I want to interject here because I think a lot of people aren't aware of the extent to which behaviorism and this, you know, Skinner approach has influenced the world that we live in. So just a couple of examples in the workplace, the idea that we need to incentivize, you know, high performance, like rewarding salespeople with a, you know, higher commission, the more that they perform, came out of this behaviorist, you know, approach, and even I would argue, you know, compulsory schooling, and the way that traditional education is set up to reward certain behaviors extrinsically with grades, and you know, you should do this because you're supposed to, and you're supposed to follow this curriculum. Is really deeply ingrained in our culture and often not even questioned or challenged. And it's only been recently through some, you know, Adam Grant and other people in the business community who've been saying, hey, and you know, I think the research DC and others did in this field that directly contradicts that, that shows that if you extrinsically reward certain behaviors in the workplace, either they're not going to increase. Or if they do increase, it can often have toxic side effects, you know, creating a bad culture, you know, to live in. And if you force a kid, for example, to learn to read at a time where they're not re yet ready to read because that's what the curriculum says should be happening, those kids can sometimes have then a lifelong aversion to reading later on, you know, through. So this is like really important stuff that affects our life on a daily basis.
And I go more with the toxic side effect. Really, there's kind of nothing wrong with extrinsic incentives, performance standards. You know, we sort of need them, goals and targets, and it's nice to have more money. From the self-determination theory perspective, what matters is that they be presented and administered in an autonomy supportive way so that people can identify with the meaning of what they're doing and not just think, oh, I'm doing it for the money. And that's a little tricky. That's a much more psychological thing to try to do.
So how would that work? How would that work in a workplace environment, just as a way of fleshing this out? If, you know, compare like just, you know, purely monetary reward or commission versus what you're suggesting where the autonomy is emphasized, how would that look different?
Well, it might involve kind of establishing a sort of company atmosphere where, you know, it's not everybody for themselves trying to make as much money as they can. We're all working for the team, you know, and we're working for the company actually. And we believe in the company's goals, the company's marketing a product that's doing good in the world. You know, so you want to try to make it seem meaningful and help with people's relatedness need, we call it, of connecting with others in the work environment, not competing with them. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with incentives. It's more how they're administered that can be the problem.
So I won't hold you to this as a professional, you know, official professional opinion. Here's how we do it in our company. We have incentives that are tied to the overall performance of the company. So if the performance of the company improves, everybody participates in that and is rewarded by that, rather than saying, okay, you as an individual, if you meet this individual goal, you get this individual reward. Would you say that's more consistent with this approach, or is there still also room for individual rewards as long as that connection is explicitly made between the work the individual is doing and the greater good, so to speak, both within the company and then outside world, the work the company's doing?
Yeah. I might come down on the side of doing both. But you have to be really careful because the one can undermine the other. It's much more difficult. The disadvantage of having it be purely a company-based reward is that from a game theory perspective, you might be doing a lot to help the company, but there's other people who are corrupt or they're screwing off. The free rider problem, social loafing, and you might end up feeling pretty pissed off about your situation if you're, you know, so it's cooperation versus defection in the game theory perspective. Yep.
So I'm a big fan of models. I think you might be as well. You've created several of them in your professional work. Back in 2005, you proposed the sustainable happiness model, and this had, three overlapping influences that all contribute to happiness. One was genetic predisposition, which we've talked a little bit about. The other two were life circumstances and intentional activities. So and I know your thinking has changed since then. So can you tell us a little bit, just, I think models really help people to kind of broadly understand something and then put the potential things they could do into categories and just, you know, conceptually remember those things a little bit more easily.
That was a very influential model, and we've kind of backed away from it a little bit because of what we learned about, you know, how genetics interact with environmental factors and a lot of complexities. What we stand by now is the idea that activities are more impactful than circumstances, and by circumstances we mean sort of static factors like where you live, how much money you make, your gender. They're just kind of facts. And surprising findings in early happiness research was that these facts didn't make much of a difference, not as much as you would think. Like income only correlates about 0.15 with well-being, which is not a big correlation.
No.
And so what we say is, well, the thing about facts is you can adapt to them very easily. Hedonic adaptation, you get used to them. They're not doing anything for you. You don't think about them. The advantage of an activity, which it's a broad category, but and a goal is just one example, pursuing a goal, is that you're doing something that involves intentional. And so you can get into that eudaimonic category if you make good choices, where you're doing activities that bring you satisfaction and well-being. In that original model, we didn't distinguish the quality of the activity. We just said activities are better than circumstances. Now I would add to that and say eudaimonic activities are better than hedonistic or self-centered activities.
Right. So I know from reading some of your work and you know what you just said, of course, that activity is more important than circumstance. And the reason for that is our circumstances just tend to become the new normal. There's no longer any activity that's related to that circumstance. But if that's true, does it follow that if I do kind of create some kind of ongoing activity or relationship with that circumstance, can I extract or gain more well-being from that circumstance?
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons we've backed away from the activity circumstance distinction, is that it's very hard to separate them cleanly. And so your circumstance of having, you know, you make a pretty good income, that's not a circumstance if you're using that money to do a lot of satisfying things, satisfying activities. And the same thing with a marriage. In one sense, it's a status, a demographic status. But in another sense, it's a context for you to do a lot of cool stuff. So my wife and I would travel around. You know, we like to hang out and just, you know, talk about stuff. So I use my marriage as a source of satisfying activity. And that's the main thing to keep in mind.
Would even just gratitude play that role, or does it have to be like more of an activity? Like, you know, I'm going on a trip, I'm using the income I make to create this new life experience, which leads to more well-being. Could even the act of just appreciating or being grateful for a circumstance in your life, like, wow, I walk outside of my house, I'm so grateful to be living in this place that I live because it nourishes me in all these different ways. Does that have an impact?
Yeah, that's another tricky thing between experience and activity. I guess I would say that when you walk at your house and say that to yourself, it's because you've adopted some kind of intention to live life in a joyous way. And that makes you more likely to do the activity of noticing, wow, a beautiful morning. I'm going to sit and express to myself how good it makes me feel. So I'm going to turn that into an activity. But it is true that just mental events can have positive effects, like mindfulness meditation. You're not doing a thing except noticing what comes across your view screen. But even there, you sat yourself down and said, I'm not doing anything but watching.
Mm-hmm. I'm a longtime meditator. It's one of the greatest gifts my father gave me was taking me to meditation class when I was 17. So coming up on almost 30 years. And, you know, I could talk a lot about that, but I want to talk about it from the perspective of happiness and well-being. What does the research say about the role, you know, the impact or role of mindfulness meditation or other types of meditation on well-being?
Well, first of all, it is a positive psychology intervention that works, that tends to boost people's well-being on average, but not for everybody, especially if it's something you really take to, it's meaningful for you. Well, how does it work? Well, it could be that it gets you to notice and savor and appreciate things that you would take for granted. But the other side of it, and this is the Kabat-Zinn perspective, PTSD, that it gets you to notice these negative thoughts and feelings that may be hanging you up and sort of let them flow through you and thereby kind of release them. So mindfulness meditation may work as a weaker version of psychedelic therapy.
Mm-hmm. So it's allowing you to return more to your natural set point by disidentifying with the constant stream of thoughts or a habitual stream of thought loop or habitual
that keeps showing
loop
up and taking charge and dragging you down.
Right. Helps you to actually see that those things are just transitory, you know, sensations or firing of neurons in the brain, that they're not necessarily you or they don't mean anything about you. I want to step back a little bit since we're on this kind of broader topic. And there's been a lot of discussion, you know, Sam Harris talks a lot about this and, you know, physicists will talk about this idea of free will. We're talking about this big question of, can we pursue happiness, which implies that we have the free will to be able to do that. Whereas, you know, many physicists and prominent thinkers today are arguing that we live in a deterministic universe where free will is an illusion. So, and I know that you've thought about this. It was mentioned in your bio, and we were chatting before the show about a book that you're writing that might be somewhat related. So, what are your thoughts on this? Another huge topic. Like we could talk for hours, but yeah, just maybe some highlights of how you're thinking about this right now.
Yeah, I'll just give you the thumbnail sketch of what I'm saying in my book, which should come out in 2022 with basic books. The idea is that free will is real. It's actually inescapable. Somebody has to make choices for our brain, and that somebody is us. The symbolic self, the story, the life story that we live in as the major character within that story. And in one sense, all I'm saying is that free will involves just three related capacities. You can think up some alternatives. I could do X, Y, or Z. You can make a choice. Z, I'm going to do Z. And then you can start taking action to pursue Z. And this is the model of free will that philosopher Christian List proposed in his 2019 book called Free Will is Real. And I looked at that and I said, whoa, because I've been studying that my whole career. Yeah. And here's a philosopher saying this. And the problem in philosophy, as you may know, is that it's just a tremendously complex debate over there. And it's totally bogged down.
Yeah.
And Christian List stepped out of the philosophy and said, hey, it's a psychological question. And then I said, hey, I've been studying this my whole career. So the idea is, you know, we're making choices. We don't know about everything that's going on in our brain. We don't cause the alternatives to show up in front of our view screen, but we do ask for them. We say, what can I do here to ourselves? And then our non-conscious mind provides alternatives. And then we say, which one do I want? And then we pick one. And that this is we might even be collapsing the quantum wave function with these choices that we make in life. I don't want to get into that.
Yeah, that's another fascinating topic that could go on and on. So we're creating another world in the many worlds hypothesis with our choice. Yeah,
some weird way. But so the upshot of the book is free will is real. We might try to escape it because we don't want responsibility or we don't want to screw up our lives, but it's real. And so the real thing we need to do is accept it and learn to use it more wisely. And so that brings us around to self-concordant goal choice, using our free will in a way that satisfies us and also helps the broader world around us.
So on that subject, you know, you've said the what and the why both matter in terms of goal selection. The content of the goal, what are we striving towards, and why is it important to us? But even within that, is there still yet another hierarchy? You've said, I'm going to quote you here, I can't remember the exact paper, but the best happiness boosting behaviors tend to be the ones that focus on long-term self-improvement and on deepening connections with others. So does that represent like another hierarchy within a hierarchy, so to speak? I mean, it seems like the most important thing is having a clear why and choosing goals that are, you know, maybe generally doing good. But within that, is you know, connection to others and growth and self-discovery and maybe self-actualization, are those you know, even more powerful in terms of goal setting?
Well, that was a very interesting question, because it kind of gets into a different kind of major argument I'm making in the book, which is that the symbolic self, the person that we feel ourselves to be, who is driving our own minds and making choices, has two basic responsibilities. A, running its body, deciding where the body goes, taking care of the body, and also the body's development and growth an increase in complexity. We can talk about from an information theory perspective. But at the same time, the symbolic self also is responsible for meshing ourselves with other selves out in the social world. So our own self is like at the waist of an hourglass, with the body below and society above. Again, we evolved to want to grow, develop, become the best versions of ourselves. And a big part of that is by helping our social surrounds become their best versions. Mm-hmm. You know, so really we're trying to evolve. Not just in the natural selection sense, but in the personal sense and the social sense. And so those tend to be the most satisfying things that we can do.
I love that. And again, you know, can't escape the tie-in with health coaching. Is just like, that's really what we say we're doing, helping people to become better, the best possible versions of themselves. And I want to, you know, as the last question, ask you on that note a little more about what we know about the relationship between health and happiness. And it seems to me there's a bi-directional relationship here, where health, having good health, contributes in some way to feelings of subjective well-being. Certainly, I'm not sure, it's not as clear to me how that contributes to eudaimonic well-being, But there's also a lot of research that suggests that happiness contributes to health, that it works the other way around. And that's, you know, all my listeners know this, I struggled with a really complex chronic illness for many, many years. And what I discovered in that process was that if I only focused on improving my health, like, and I define that as eliminating symptoms or disease, I missed out on life. And that it was actually by also focusing on cultivating, intentionally cultivating happiness, that not only increased my happiness, but it actually circled back and improved my health in ways that I wouldn't have anticipated, you know, prior to having that experience. So I'm just curious if you, you know, I don't know if this, how much you've looked into this, if this is your area, but like, what is that relationship between happiness and what we would typically refer to as health, you know, physiological health?
Yeah. So I don't study health so much, but the way I would tend to think about it is that if you have poor health, that gets in the way of eudaimonic striving.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's kind of like if your machine is damaged, you can't drive it as
well.
If you're
bedridden, the ways that you can pursue happiness are going to be limited.
Again, I don't want to say pursue happiness.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's the way Thomas Jefferson put it, but it doesn't work if that's the way you think about it. So it helps not to have at least an okay functioning body. And of course, again, we're responsible for trying to make that happen. But if that's all we care about, like you said, you know, we're also responsible for having rich things happen out in the social and cultural world. And the nice thing about that is, you know, even if you're bedridden, if you know, you can become the leader of some organization or cause that brings you many fulfilling experiences. And then that can feed back to affect your health, because we know there's a connection between emotions and immune functioning and physical functioning.
Right. So I have to decondition my language myself. It's interesting how deeply ingrained some of this stuff is, like pursuing happiness. It's in the constitution of our country. So how would you say that? Like, you wouldn't say cultivating happiness or pursuing happiness, because happiness is the side effect or the byproduct of what it is that we're doing, the eudaimonic striving. So how would you phrase that? Like cultivating eudaimonia, which is a term that, you know, right over people's head.
I would say cultivating growth and connection. You know, there's a lot of ways to expand those two words, but you know, one of them is a personality process. One is a social process, but you know, they influence each other. And if we can do them both together, we'll thrive to the maximal extent.
Right. So that goes right back to the quote that I read, where we're cultivating growth and we're cultivating connection. And that's what leads to an increase in our happiness and well-being. Perfect. I love that. So thank you so much, Ken. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and love to have you back on the show when your book comes out, if you're open to it, so we can dive a little bit more deeply into those topics of free will. I know I'm fascinated by it. I know a lot of the listeners are as well. And it's a pretty juicy, controversial subject right now too. So I'd love to.
Well, I'm still going back and forth with my editor on how strongly to argue the free will position. You know, maybe all I'm saying is, oh, it's possible that there's free will. And,
right.
Oh, what would that look like? And so,
right.
Yeah, but I'd be happy to come back and talk about that later.
Yeah, such important topics. So thanks again. And is there somewhere, do you have a website or anywhere people can find out about your work and stay in touch with you?
If you type my name, Kenan Sheldon, you'll find my Missouri website, which has some information about me.
Great. Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. Keep sending your questions in to chriskresser.com/podcast question. We'll see you next time. The COVID-19 pandemic wreaked havoc on our institutions, our society, and almost every aspect of our lives. Yet within each crisis is a silver lining, an opportunity to reinvent ourselves, to discover a new path, and to take a leap of faith into the life we want to live. I know from speaking with a lot of you that this includes finding more meaningful and rewarding work. COVID has shown us that life is too short to do work that doesn't make us come alive and allow us to contribute to a better world. If you enjoyed this episode and you're interested in the topics we discussed, you might want to learn more about the profession of health coaching and what it has to offer. We've put together a resource page that explains what a health coach is. Hint, it's probably not what you think. How training as a health coach can change your life as well as your future clients' lives, and an ebook about what a career as a health coach might look like. You can find it all for free at cresser.co/discover. That's cresser.co/discover. That's the end of this episode of Revolution Health Radio. If you appreciate the show and want to help me create a healthier and happier world, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They really do make a difference. If you'd like to ask a question for me to answer on a future episode, you can do that at chriscresser.com/podcastquestion. You can also leave a suggestion for someone you'd like me to interview there. If you're on social media, you can follow me at twitter.com/chriscresser or facebook.com/chriscresserlac. I post a lot of articles and research that I do throughout the week there that never makes it to the blog or podcast, so it's a great way to stay abreast of the latest developments. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.